You want credit for beating the Mets?
Well, it's a new day.
No, no, my father always said, beat the teams you're supposed to beat. If you got swept by the Mets, then you go into hiding. You beat the Mets.
True.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
All right. Well, here we are. Welcome to another episode of Moran Python Radio. In this episode, we are talking about slugs, among other things. What is a slug? What causes a slug? What
are a snail
tips?
Without a shell? And I suppose what causes it is nature and evolution. Yes. Right, it's been a quick episode, and there you go.
All right.
Riley, I don't know why we even brought you here.
We didn't even bring Riley.
Yeah, we didn't even hear up.
I'm just here for the good looks.
There you go.
Yeah, we have a special guest, Riley Jimison from Riley's Reptiles, coming and hanging out with us to talk about it. We've had discussions about El Nino this season with slugs, and I thought maybe it would be a good topic to hit on. You don't hear a lot of people talk about it, and turns out that there's not a lot of information out there on the topic. So
yeah,
take what we say with a grain of salt. It's sort of, our thoughts, and we're thinking out loud doesn't necessarily mean anything is...
And I think between
in stone as
right
science,
between the three of us, I think each of us has had that season where it's just like, open the egg box slugs and then open this egg box slugs. It's like,
yeah,
well, it's just punch after punch. So that's happened to, I think, all three of us. I think Riley is in the midst of it currently.
Yeah,
so, but I had mine a couple years ago where it was. It's horribly disappointing. It just sucks.
Yeah. So I kind of feel like there's this dance that happens between the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S., right?
Yeah.
And I think that, like, when the East Coast has a really good season, the West Coast seems to have not so good of a season. And that is somehow tied into El Nino. I couldn't really figure out, like, what it is that that causes that, or what could be what it is that's causing that, other than the fact of the lack of
a winterish
below normal rainfall.
Yeah. Well, and also
in the Pacific,
I believe that if I am correct in how doomed our planet is, that the amount of El Ninos used to not happen as often as they do. It used to be like, I think I remember as a kid, it being a thing that was like, we're tracking this El Nino thing, and now it's just like, oh, it's another El Nino summer, whatever. It's like, okay. So,
right.
Yeah. And the planet isn't doomed. We as a species is doomed. The ball is still going to keep going around the sun. So,
yeah. You eject the big monkey.
Oh, yeah.
Smart monkey.
Kill the monkeys because they ruined it. And yeah, there we go.
Another version will evolve later.
Exactly.
Yes. So I don't know. I tend to think, if you have the idea of the, cosmic octopus, now everything's sort of entwined and works together, and it's kind of amazing if you think about it, but I would imagine that it has to have some impact. And we were talking before the show, some of the articles that I looked up talked about El Nino's impact on cobra sightings surge due to climate change and habitat disruption. So maybe El Nino is good for herping, bad for breeding. I don't know. Jury's still out. We'll see. But yeah, I don't know. Owen, do you have anything you want to hit on before we dive right
in? Before we dive in, I have now successfully gotten eggs from 20 different reptile species.
20?
20.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Got the ad.
And Riley, you've checked off another Morelia in
Yep. And
Darwin's
potentially a
finally.
Second one if I don't jinx it. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Darwin's. Yeah. I've got 7 babies comfortably out and 5 more taking their time in the eggs. And I'm just a happy camper.
All you need is one hatchling and then it's just like it's done. So,
yeah.
So
hey, I'm not complaining.
Question. Yeah.
Because I've always felt that. Where I've heard that Darwins are a little bit trickier to breed. Did you do anything differently, or is it just a different pairing, or what is your thoughts when it comes to breeding Darwins?
I didn't do anything differently, and it was a different pairing. It was two different animals. I think some of the factors involved were that the male that I had, when I got him as a little guy, he went on a food strike for a very long time. And so he was kind of timid, and his whole life, he was just a really bashful kind of individual. So I never saw him actively pursuing a female. I never really saw him like I caught a few locks, don't get me wrong, but I never got the feeling that he was really like gung ho about it. The female I had, I think I got her too big, too young, too fast, too early. And she ended up passing away of a big cancerous tumor. So I don't know if that played a role in there. But yeah, basically, I think I had, you know, I don't think the female was anything wrong. I think is what I did with her. If I'd have, you know, fed her and raised her the way I know now, as opposed to the way I did 10 years ago or whatever, where I got her, you know, conversation might be different if I, you know, maybe then applied a different male. But yeah, I think I was just kind of doomed to that pair at a certain point. And so I got a young male from Nick a year and a half ago, raised him up a bit, and then got another female who's already proven, and put them through the same system I do for the Papuans, Coastals, and Jungles. And here we are.
That worked.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you say, I'm curious, when you say that you didn't, like, you feel that the raising of the animal was off, is it too much food, too little food? What?
I think without putting like any sort of anecdote, like science to it, like anecdotally, I broke her. I was very much in my early Morelia years thinking, I was of the mind of just so fixated on how big of a meal these animals can eat. And I didn't know about, you know, giving them more time in between meals, kind of just judging when to feed them based off of behavior and body condition combined. I was kind of very much schedule based early on and just way overdid it. Yeah. And I think I just pushed her too large, and it was just a huge strain on all of her organs. And she just got way too big, too young. And at that point it was just kind of over. And she, yeah,
gotcha.
She just developed a big old tumor.
Wow. That sucks.
That I have a feeling with older Morelia, it's like, how did it die? Mostly cancer. And then like And then it's either that or lived to be 20s.
Do you think that's diet? Do you think that's,
I mean,
what do you think that's due to?
I mean,
genetics? Inbreeding?
It's probably everything. It has some factor, yeah. But I think you can certainly cause renal and kidney failure and fatty liver disease and things like that by excessive feeding, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and also the issue is that, and I keep seeing this, is that in the rodents that we breed, they're very susceptible to tumors and stuff like that. So,
very dietary. Yes,
right. So even if the rodent that we're feeding doesn't have any tumors on it, you know, it maybe that one got lucky. So,
yeah.
And also we're dealing with such a weird range of genetics and things like that because of our situations and what we have, that it's like, oh, well, this strain is known for cancer. Well, that strain is everywhere now. It's mixed in with everything. It's all part of it. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, maybe it's like you have predisposition genetically to cancer, and the diet
doesn't help you.
Accentuates that.
Sure.
You know, later on.
And sometimes it's luck of the draw. Like I had that clutch of bread lye this year where we had like 16 babies and 8 of them developed cancerous lumps in their stomachs. Babies. And it's like, well, shit, you know, but all the other ones are fine.
It's kind of like, I think Ron is doing something with emeralds where he's feeding African sulfurs that have only been fed fruit and veggies.
Yeah, he's working on that to see how it affects the regurgitation in a group of his emeralds, because he was seeing it a lot. And then as soon as he switched them to rodents that were eating fresh produce and things, they stopped doing it, like a chunk, like 18 of them, a significant number of them. And then as soon as he switched them back to these rodents that were eating normal rodent chow, he said due to a, just he was lazy and didn't go get produce and stuff, then they started regurgitating again. And for whatever reason, that group just seemed to be doing it. And so he's exploring that further. And I think there's something to it, because having managed the rat and mouse colonies and stuff at work for so long, I do see a propensity for a lot of tumor development in these animals that are fed solely just that Missouri rodent chow, you know.
I mean, that's the thing is that that's the reason that the Swiss line of mice was propagated, was laboratory. Like that, that's the point of these things. And then all their diets were made for, were calculated and designed for keeping the animals alive, but then also making it so the mom could have numerous litters, because they want to keep going with that kind of stuff.
Right.
But if you lose a couple by the wayside due to tumors, it, laboratory stuff, they aren't really going to care too much about that kind of crap. And
no, because they're probably going to get tumors eventually.
Anyway. Exactly. They just replace them. They just pull more in.
So they really don't give a damn. Like, so
they just move it over to the next project. Right.
And there's always other laboratories that are just like, you know, colonies at colleges have a ton of animals, and then there are colonies at the rodent suppliers that have a ton of animals, and it's just keep breeding and going and all that stuff like that. And you're right, they all use the same kind of diet, but the whole point is this is a mouse and it costs this much to make this mouse, and we can sit here and do all the things to try to figure out how to, oh wait, here's another mouse. Like, I don't
exactly.
It's it would make sense to me only because of being in the food industry and knowing what we do to our food and how much shit we put in into it, and how we get cancer and diabetes and all these health issues as we're, you know, because we're basically eating poison. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would, I can't see why that same thing wouldn't, it's happening to the mice. So why wouldn't that happen to the snake? Well, but I don't know. It's a, it's something that for sure is an issue that pops up that maybe one day we'll get to the bottom of it. But
the other thing too, is that we don't really see it, is that, you know, the clutch in the wild, the one that maybe gets a couple tumors on it is the one that is food for something else or doesn't get out of that thing. So it's removed from the breeding.
Yeah.
In captivity, we make sure that animal has bred by the time it's like 3-4 years old before any tumors really start coming through. So it's already passed on all its genetic stuff to the next generation. And then by the time it gets to be 5 or 6 is when we start seeing problems. And so by then, cast out of the bag. So
I wonder if stress could also induce that. You know,
and stress causes a lot of other things.
I would imagine prolonged chronic stress. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Acute stress, probably not, but prolonged stress. Like if you bred your rodents in the same building as all your snakes, they'd probably be stressed a lot.
Yeah.
We, at the zoo, we had a fennec fox that always had these problems.
They're cool.
It would stress out, diarrhea, all these other problems. And then I was there one night and I finally figured out why. It's because if you looked this way at its cage, the Eurasian eagle owl was right there. Like, and it was just
dear Lord.
All day, every day, just staring at this fox. It's like, why don't we? And we shifted stuff around, and all of a sudden, she's instantly better. I'm like, cool. So when the predator isn't like staring at her 24/7, things got better. So stress is definitely something that can affect the health of an animal. And even then, like we were talking, like the main point is slugs.
Yeah,
I think stress is a big part of slugs.
Yeah.
You know,
100%.
Whether they go that extra mile, whether it's stress to the female and causes the slug, or even stress to the boy, and we don't even get the eggs fertilized because he's so stressed out. He doesn't know what the fuck to do, and he's all over the place.
How so? Sure. What do you mean that stress is causing slugs in the female? Like,
all right. So I think stress,
break that down for me.
I think stress in the female is, I think, a female snake, because we've had ones that can retain sperm, and we've had females that can ovulate several times in a year and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If she's stressed to the nines and she's going through her normal ovulation cycle, you can't tell me that that's not going to get derailed if she's stressed out and cause her to maybe not go the full cycle with the snake, with the eggs, and just kind of abort them out and just kind of slug out.
Gotcha.
You know,
if you have to move an animal,
right? Right. Like, I moved.
So she's got prime optimal conditions from point A to point B. It's as short and stress-free as possible, but the act of moving is stressful.
It's still there. And that's enough. Yeah. Like, even I imagine a boa that's fully a pregnant boa, stressed to the nines, you're going to lose the litter. Like, I imagine
boa breeders are very specific about being hands off.
Right. And I think that is something that you maybe take for granted because it's an egg layer. Because you're like, sure. Yeah, it's fine. They're not like that. We still have to make sure she gets to a certain point. And
yeah,
so I think that. And then on the other side of that coin with the male is, I think I think it's with young males, especially.
Okay.
Young first time males, you might get a lock, but I think he's so stressed out that I'm not sure he's going to be firing, you know, with a loaded gun. It's like, okay. And maybe those eggs just never get fertilized.
Well, we'll get into this at some point, but temperature, I believe, with the males.
I believe that is a very big thing.
Yeah. Seeing that chart that you shared earlier was very, you could literally see like temperature and the amount of slugs correlate and find this happy equilibrium.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's always like the first year breaking in a new room, you're like, I got it, I did it, slugs everywhere, and you're like, I didn't do it, and then like you have to and then it's tweaking this and insulating that and putting a door here, and then all of a sudden the next following year it's just you're drowning in eggs.
And I think about the episode you guys did recently, literally speaking on eggs, the discussion at least partially was focused on the female's condition the year leading up to laying has a huge effect on that. So you factor, there's a whole calendar year of, you know, extreme high and lows and stress that could be at play there.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a female that says maybe is sick for part of the year,
yeah,
and then she gets better and then you push her to get her ready for breeding season. Holy shit. You're like that's waving a red cape at a bull, in my opinion. Yeah. That's asking for trouble. It's like, give her the year off. Just give her the freaking year.
Yeah, I mean, I've run into that situation just this year, right?
Yeah.
I was going to breed the diamonds, but because, you know, I had the death in the family and all that stuff that was happening, I wasn't here to feed them. And I felt like I was too far along in the season to where, to me, it wasn't worth the...
It
wasn't worth a chance. I'd rather say, okay, I'm taking this year and just feed them up this year when I got home, and then, you know,
there's something
knock
to
them
be
out
said
next year.
To knowing when you'd rather just stop it here instead of trying to force it and prep always for next year. And I say this, and then I keep doing dumb shit and being like, I don't know, we'll chuck them together and see what happens. And then it works. And I'm like, I don't know what happened. Like, yes. So I much prefer to have a plan. Do as I say, not as I do. Okay. Right. So
fair.
Yeah.
Who wants to take a shot at what is a slug? Like, so people know what we're talking about that maybe are.
It's an infertile egg.
Well,
it is a chicken egg. It is a breakfast snake egg. It is
an ovary. Is an ovary that the female started building at some point. All of the biological cues in her cycle started going, and it just didn't get fertilized, but it went past the point of reabsorption.
Right.
It just sort of partially shelled, got some mucus and whatever in there, whatever the tissue, the yellow albumin is, and then just never cooked, never expanded, never grew with any any venous blood flow. And so what you have is a weird, abnormal looking, partially shelled thing.
What about the fact of you actually get shelled full infertile eggs? Because there was, so I was looking on the Australian forum of some Aussie snakes or whatever it is. I don't know. I haven't been there in so long, but that's the only thing that I could find that had to talk about slugs. But one of the comments where slugs are a strange thing, in my opinion, they're not simply infertile eggs. You can have fully formed eggs that aren't fertile, candled, mm-hmm. no veins present, no veins, cut open, yellow. No embryo. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows how it goes. Follicles mm-hmm. are developed and fertilized during ovulation. If the egg isn't fertilized, it's simply not fertile, not necessarily mm-hmm. a slug. In my opinion, there are underdeveloped or faulty eggs. Fault goes mainly with the female, but mm-hmm. I think that, so that was from a while ago. So now it seems to think that it's more with the male. I talked to Dr. Zach Lofman about it. Okay. He seems to think that it lies more in the male side of it, because I was asking if there's any literature on slugs and apparently not. Once the eggs have passed into the oviducts, they are beyond the point of no return, sort of like what you were saying, Riley. There's no absorptive mechanisms that can be found in the oviducts. If the eggs are not successfully fertilized, they will eventually be passed as unfertilized ova, or what we commonly call slugs.
Yeah, that is interesting why some come out yellow and very obviously slugs, and others do come out fully shelled, seemingly fertile until you candle them. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe it was, you know, maybe a resource thing in the female, and she put out this number of follicles, but the male wasn't able to fertilize all of them. But she had the resources to develop them better than if it was just a bunch of those slugs. Maybe it's probably one or two amidst a good healthy clutch as opposed to a whole litany of them. So maybe it's just she put out this many resources, he was only capable of devoting this many resources.
Right. It's like there should be a difference between an unfertilized egg and a slug.
Yeah. So
an unfertilized, though, because I think we kind of call them all slugs, and that's not true. An unfertilized egg is an unfertilized egg. A slug is a slug.
Right. Yeah. Slugs are kind of like, I kind of think of them as like, they kind of remind me of like a colubrid egg. Like when you have a python that's laying eggs and you get these, like, they're kind of long and kind of like pointy on the end, almost footballish looking.
Yeah.
And they have a yellow tinge to them, I guess.
Hue. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think some slugs so you have the egg of like your carpet python, and then the slug is smaller. Mm-hmm. Smaller, maybe less shaped. I've gotten slug or like ova out of boa litters, where it's like you got the babies, which are, you know, in their little sacks, but then you have one that is just a sack full of, looks like a slug. It's just got the yellowish fluid in there. There's no baby, and it just never got to a certain point. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's true.
Do you think, I haven't been able to find any confirmation on this, but I've always heard this rumor that slugs don't happen in the wild.
Bullshit.
I find that bullshit.
Well,
that's an interesting debate.
Well, would you know? Because, I mean, obviously infertiles happen in the wild. Has to happen. There's no way every male carpet python out there is batting 100%.
Do female carpets eat infertiles? Has anybody documented that?
Yes.
Not that I've seen. Really?
Once or twice? Or is it a thing that happens?
Well, I've only seen it once.
Let's assume it's a rarity. That if there are slugs being laid,
mom's eating them.
If she does eat them or she doesn't, but she's still incubating them, how would we know? Like, unless you're finding empty nests that haven't been touched and you confirm they haven't been touched. I mean, how would you know?
I think a female carpet would know.
It's hard to study.
I think a female carpet would know, because every time I've had a female lay slugs, she's kind of half-assed coiled them. Like, she's not beehived tight around a bunch of slugs. Like it, they're all kind of scattered a little bit, maybe loose, kind of a little bit on it. So I almost feel like a female python would kind of realize that ain't nothing going on here and leave. And either she eats them after that or she goes, and you can't have something that nutritional and sought after out without getting eaten by a possum, a goanna, something. Like those things right. are gone. And I almost feel like unless you catch her before she realizes that what she has laid are slugs, I don't think you necessarily, I don't think you find her.
This is where my crazy brain goes. Mm. I don't know. This is just the thought. You guys, especially Owen, you probably say I'm nuts.
Yeah, okay, good.
do you think that a female python may produce slugs in the wild as sort of eat these, not my eggs type of situation? And why she pushes them out of her coils?
Nah. Because if you're something big and bad enough, you're just gonna be like, you know, snake, you're gonna right? eat the eggs and then you're gonna kill her. Like,
yeah, you know, it's, I would think so too.
No,
yeah, good point.
Lace monitor would be like, you're right, I have now had these two slugs, I shall leave you be. No, it's going to be like, well,
that's not how nature works.
Yeah, that's not how nature works.
No, I will eat all of these and you. No,
then the lace monitor kills the carp, eats the eggs. Yeah.
Thanks for the appetizer.
Now you're next. No.
So am I correct in thinking that boas do eat those like unfertile
they do.
Bova?
They do.
Yeah, they do.
I think I've seen anacondas do that. Yeah.
Okay. Some female boas will eat dead DOA babies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I filmed my rainbows doing it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's next year, buddy. Next year. I get to ride the rainbow, and they're vicious killing machines. Yeah, they're vicious killing machines, those rainbows. Oh, my God. Just
feed her real well, and she'll be good.
I do feed her well. She's still a bitch.
I'm saying as far as breeding.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. No. Attitude, she's too far gone. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that must be something, Owen, if you're the one that's saying that she's...
I don't like them because they do that thing where... You know, they'll grab on to something or me, and then they're just like death. And it's like, yeah.
They're fun. I still get to work with them at work. So I still have some to my name. Actually, one of the ones at the shop is one that I produce. So that's kind of fun.
It's one of those where I'm like, cool, let's get some more boas in here. And then I'm going to do it and be like, I hate boas. Like, it's going to be one of those like getting out. So.
I like when they're hissy little dragons.
We'll see.
Yeah, they kind of do that, like that rear up.
But you have them
halfway out type of thing.
And you're right, them, and they do that hissing and they do that stuff. But then you look in like a couple racks over, I have my Argentines, where it's like, you know,
have they chilled down at all?
Never. And I love them. No, but they're fantastic. I love them that way. So
they're exactly who I was thinking of.
Yeah. So exactly. They're fine.
Oh man. Okay. So what do you guys think as far as we sort of hit on this back and forth, but like male or female, where do you put in your experience, where has the we'll start with you, Riley. Where has your experience been with them? Where do you dial it down to or do you not know?
I mean, I don't think I could say definitively one way or the other, but if I had to pick a side, I would say it's probably more the female, because assuming the male gets in at the right time, all he has to do is lock up once, you know, breed her one time and that's that. But if she's not conditioned well, hasn't eaten enough, doesn't have access to the right climate, is stressed too much, you know, he could do everything right. And it's a crapshoot from any point in time, potentially. Now, that doesn't mean he can't do things wrong. I just feel like after reading some of that data that you sent over, you know, all the potential different variables at play, it seems like more can go wrong for a female to ruin her season leading up to that point, whereas a male can kind of have a whole host of things and maybe be a little more tolerant of it. But it comes down to temperature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot. And so if she's not able to find good, safe, secure areas with a lot of food at the right temperature, and she's just doing the best she can, but the male who's wandering all over the place and following scent trails and hunting along the way and kind of probably has more access to various, you know, shelter environments, because we know the males travel a lot more. Maybe he's not as adversely affected by that, and she is.
Yeah. I kind of feel like if we're going to split it and say there's infertile eggs and then there's slugs, I feel like infertile eggs is the male's fault. Like, you did not get that one, and that is your fault. So if it's like fully shelled and it's especially with other fertilized eggs, I feel like that's male's fault.
What about a clutch with like three or four fertiles and then like a ton of infertiles?
I think that's his fault. I think that's on him. Where it's like, maybe a sperm count was just bad, or maybe he just didn't get it in at the right time, or he was not where he was supposed to be. Like I said, and it could also be that she didn't ovulate at the right time or some other stuff like that. But I feel like more is put on the male for an infertile egg. Sure. Where a slug, where it like got to a certain point and then stopped. I think that's a little bit more on the female. But again, I think there's wriggle room for both, where it's like, well, did she get to a certain point because the male was in there and then some dumbass hooked the male out right before he could get in there to breed her? And
sure,
there was nothing in those eggs, just kept going. And I don't know. Like, I don't know what it also, I think it depends with some girls will reabsorb and some girls will slug out. So my roughy back here, my female. Mm-hmm. The one on the top.
Right.
She was paired this year and she went off food for a while and she blew up like a balloon. And I'm like, here we go. She's now back on food and she's eating like she has not eaten in several months, which is true. Mm-hmm. She's also doing things like she's climbing a shit ton. She's on branches. She's on sticks. She's not curled up in her hide. She's not making divots and mulch like they were last year. She is all over the place. I'm thinking.
Did you had the male in there, presumably the same amount?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Did anything change for the entire calendar year for her leading up to it?
I mean, she had eggs. She laid last year. So that may have thrown her off. Like it was. But
and that was her first time?
First time?
That was her first year. Yep.
Okay. First so it's year her first time years. Going through from hatch to 4 or 5 years until taking that 4 or 5 years of.
Right.
Life's experiences and growth and everything and devoting all it into its first clutch.
Right.
And all of a sudden she's trying to catch up in 8, 9, 10 months and do it again.
I mean, I'll tell you this first off, both girls went right back onto food after laying the eggs.
Right. One, see, some handle it in grace and style.
Right.
Go calendar year after calendar year.
And she was the one who did. The other female who laid like 16 eggs and was the first girl, she did not bounce back as much, but she was much bigger. So that female was on loan from another breeder who had lost his male and sent her to me. I breed her twice. We split the clutch and then she's mine.
Sure.
She had not been bred and she was huge. The biggest rough scale I've ever seen. And she had 16 eggs.
Nice.
And she did not bounce back as quickly as the other female, who I think was right on par with other roughies as well as other carpets, and only had 10 eggs.
Here's as you're saying that, Owen, something pops into my head, and again, this is just a thought. What if females really are not supposed to breed every year?
They're not.
Some do, right?
Yeah.
But in the wild, we all know that they don't, and we know why they don't. And the reason that we do it in captivity is because they're not in the wild. We can feed them. They don't have to, you know, they we can get them up faster. We're pulling the eggs. So they're not actually incubating the eggs for the most part. So there's that whole 3 months of time that they're not, you know, not eating or whatever.
Right. And in the captive setting, they can get 3 times the amount of food in one calendar year that they would in the wild, potentially under our care, even with us being sparing. I mean, shit, they could have a bad year and it's like a really dry season. And an adult female, even after having a successful clutch, might not get her first meal for 4 months after that, depending on when those babies hatch.
It's hilarious with some of mine where it's like they lay their eggs and it's like 20 something egg clutch. and you give them like two meals and it's like nothing happened. Like they're right back where they should be. Yeah. And it's just like, right. I'm like, I hadn't fed you for like, you haven't eaten for months. You
there's something to be said about being spoiled in human care for sure.
So there's that whole part of it. So, I mean, when it comes down to it, I'm not concerned about her. But again, to finish the story, I am half expecting her to lay slugs, but part of me thinks she just reabsorbed. Where we got to that point, the male had not been in there at the right time. They, for whatever reason, weren't locking. The male didn't produce anything. I'm not sure. Because the male's proven as well. It's the same boy. They didn't click this year. So, and I also will admit that I was half-assing it because I had a lot of shit here. Like there was a lot of babies. And I'm like, oh no, I didn't get a clutch of Python. Like I was...
Right.
And were you running him to multiple females as well?
Nah, I only gave the one. I was only giving the one girl. I did put him in with the other female because I was kind of thinking get that second clutch and kill that loan. But I'd rather just give it a year.
Play it safe.
I'd rather do that than have another
healthier issue. For everybody involved. Yeah. You included.
Yeah, exactly. Not like, you know, and it's just kind of a little bit easier that way. And then next year I'll hit it a little harder and I'll pay more attention to their temps a little bit and really make sure we get some stuff in here. Like maybe it's one of those where I have to leave the office door open a couple nights in winter to make sure it really gets down to a cooler temp. So, but I think even that she went through all the points, even that I think she reabsorbed. Mm. I don't think she's going to lay slugs.
What do you think causes them to reabsorb? Is that
that too?
Yeah,
I think nothing happened, and they're like, well, then their body just they can control that, and
I feel like that comes down to a lot of timing in two ways. I think there's probably a cutoff point for them where if they don't have a certain amount of resource,
or a certain hormone isn't released at a certain
point. Yeah, if those two things don't happen at the same time. And the male isn't in at the same time breeding her, giving her good viable sperm to reproduce with. If those like three variables don't occur within probably and I would imagine the window varies from species to species. Like I'm pretty sure it's a very narrow, precise window for things like ring pythons, but maybe not so much like carpets, but maybe it is a bit for roughies.
Right. I think ovulation in a white lip can be, I think they were observed. It's like 24 hours. It's sure. Like, If she blows up like a balloon and then it's gone. And it's like, and if the boy wasn't there, like, it's
You want to make sure the male was either in before or right then.
Right.
And he could go in one time. And as long as he does a good job that one time,
that's what makes their species such like an Indiana Jones thing is because it's like, well, also if you put him in early, she might try to kill him. And it's like, well, Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance to that species, whereas maybe not so much in some others.
Again, I'm just throwing out ideas. I'm going to be the crazy person in this.
I hate you,
chat.
I hate episodes well,
the,
like this.
You know, the crazy questions are the ones that elicit crazy findings.
I like to think outside
the
box.
You make me think, and I hate it.
I saw this video a long time ago that talked about light cycles with snakes, right? Particularly pythons. Mm-hmm. And that just as when we wake up, we release certain hormones to tell us to be awake. And then we go on a clock from that point that I think it's like 15 hours maybe or whatever it is.
Before psychotic
you're going to be, you're going to release melatonin to put you to sleep, right? So if you know how like python keepers will say light cycles matter, some say they don't, so, you know, so what if, as you said, with hormones, right? Mm-hmm. What if it has something to do with that as far as the male with sperm and sperm counts? And you know what I mean? Like, could that be an effect of having a light cycle that may or may not? I'm not saying, because obviously we've bred snakes where people don't have it on a light cycle. There goes your light cycle now.
Yeah, I know. Damn it.
Right.
Hold on.
I don't know. Crazy thought. I might be totally off base with that thinking or whatever, but I think that there's more below the surface than we
I agree.
We know.
I pay attention to the light cycle, and I do what I can. Like, everything that has lights is on timers, and I'm actively pursuing putting lights in this entire stack of cages behind me. I've kind of got the logistics figured out. I'm just kind of scared to drill holes and a little trepidatious at first, but
yeah,
I should just, you know, sit or get off the pot, as we say. But yeah, I like to adjust my light cycles to accommodate what's kind of going outside, especially when it comes to winter and summer. And then the two in between, spring and fall, I'll kind of do some half adjustments here and there. But, you know, if I come into the snake room and I'm seeing light come through the window, but the lights aren't on, I'm going to adjust that, and vice versa. If the lights are on, but it's looking a little dark outside, I'll probably crank that back, but then like maybe allow just like one overhead ambient light for a bit before everything goes on. And I just try to be respectful of that. And if lights go out, if I'm in the middle of something, that's kind of it, unless it's feeding, which is fine to feed after dark. But like, yeah, after that, I try to just stick to that very strict regimen, because I just assume I don't understand enough of what's going on in them. Sure. So
yeah,
I would rather not discount it.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like one of those things to where, it seems to work without it. But like,
sure,
when I have problems that pop up, slugs, yeah. Egg binding, you know, reabsorption, you know, all of these issues that come in when you're reproducing pythons, that, you know, maybe we're just chalking it up as, just laid slugs, you know, like really not trying to figure out like why. Not that maybe we even could. I don't know if that's possible or not.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we're just honest with ourselves and like considering variables, we'll probably never nail it down, but we can do better in some of those variables if we think maybe we've not considered them enough one year. Like maybe last year I didn't have enough money to fill the freezer as much as I wanted, as often as I did. And so maybe I slacked a little bit here and there, and I definitely stopped feeding certain females, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to produce as much. I don't want to produce as much. So I prioritize certain females.
Sure.
But then I also know I was very focused on trying to get the room like to 60 degrees for the Crebos and stuff. And that probably had a hindrance factor for things like coastals, which have just dumped nothing but slugs on me this year.
Right.
And there's also there are also things outside of our control, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But then even further, like you really want to like get into it. It's like, have you seen that what used to be a large rodent is now slowly becoming like,
yes,
things absolutely. I used to feed that were considered smalls are now considered mediums. Mm-hmm. And so the food item has gone down.
I know. When I went to feed from the food you brought me, I'm like, this is nothing like what it was right. bad or anything.
Yeah, but
it was just so different than what I would normally get.
Right.
You know, from, Cold Blooded Cafe.
Right. So I need to, need to get, there's that whole aspect. And let's say what is it? 2 years ago, I was doing a lot more chicken feed. Because a lot of my animals were eating medium rats, and I could not source medium rats to save my freaking life. So I was doing a lot of like the whole arm wing of a chicken, of that to feeding to my carpet. So it was like rodent feeding, chicken feeding, stuff like that. And that is kind of that tapered off this year. So maybe that's an aspect of it, too.
That was right before your banner year, right?
Yeah. That was when I was mixing it up with the food before like everything laid eggs and it needed to stop.
Right.
So again, this year I'm kind of like, here's food, whatever. Like I'm not hitting it like next year, man. Like I've already started stocking the fridge for the freezer. It's a freezer that I could comfortably, like Eric could live in it for at least a weekend, like the size of my freezer.
Right.
And could lay down nice. But it's, I'm stocking that getting ready because like, dude, it's already June, you know?
Yeah.
Riley, it's almost our birthdays.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
You didn't think about that, did you?
No.
Yeah.
It usually requires somebody to remind
me. That was me last week, or somebody's like, it's almost June. I'm like, shit. Oh shit. Yeah. So it's stocking it like that is what I think is going to push it. And but there are also other aspects, like you finally get the pair that clicks. You know, maybe you're getting slugs because this mail is shit and it's just not working out.
Sure. Yeah, he could be infertile. I'm sure.
I can't get any Kribos to have any eggs here. None.
Yeah. None. There's always compatibility, too. You know, right. Like you, if you had a larger sample size, you could probably reasonably tease out that like this male goes better with this female or two versus this female right. or two. You know, if you had a large sample size and just said, I'm only working on compatibility in X species and I'm going to have 30 males and 60 females, and you could probably see a small pattern, but nobody's doing that because that's just right. heinous and ridiculous and expensive. But like in theory, you could argue that that is probably a factor at play somewhere.
That's why the fringe species stuff is so hard. And it's like,
yeah,
because you have all your eggs in one basket. Right. You know, it's like yeah. I only have 1.1 Timors. Like mm-hmm. if they don't breed, it's either her fault or his fault or my fault. So it's only three right. people here. There's only three things yeah. that are going to be here. So
I blame the food monkey.
I blame the food monkey all the goddamn
Me too.
Time.
Me too. This year, I've literally pushed myself to limits I never thought was capable. I you know, I have a 9-to-5, so I have so much time where I'm not home. And then I have so much time where I am home. And then I have so much time where I try to not be, you know, focused only on the snake room. And
you also have like a wife that you would like to not divorce you. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. yeah. 9 times out of 10, that's usually a good thing. And, and so this year, you know, specifically because I do have colubrids that I don't want to keep on a Python sort of schedule or regimen, I'm like keeping two different mental compartments of like, there's the entire collection that I evaluate for feeding every yeah. week if somebody needs feeding, and then some subtle nuance in there. And then there's the very fast metabolizers, the hognose, the corn snakes, the Kribos. And I made a conscious effort to change how I fed them this year. And I thought that was going to do things differently for the breeding aspect of things on two of those species. And it's given me nothing but slugs. And so the only other variables I can think of for the corn snakes, maybe I didn't get them cold enough. For mm-hmm. the Kribos, maybe I got them too cold. And then for all the pythons that have given me slugs amidst the success with the pythons, it's probably because I was flirting with that line of ambience being just too cold for, you know, right. good production, mm-hmm. but okay within keeping them healthy. Obviously, nobody got RIs, nobody's sick. They had heat during the day, so that wasn't a factor at all. But it was probably a colder threshold than was ideal, because let's be real, I did not pay attention to that window at all this year. This winter, I left it open, whereas last right. season, I was very much micromanaging it, like 1 inch open this night. I was kind of watching nighttime drops and thresholds and really feathering it in this year. And I was like, eh, screw it. I'm leaving it open. Oh, I forgot the window open all night. Well, right. well, look at the Govey. It's like 59. Mm-hmm. That's probably okay. Everybody's right. fine, you know? And like, obviously, hindsight is 2020, probably a factor. Is it everything? Probably not, but right. it's probably a good factor, because I would argue that that was the coldest I'd got in my room. So,
and I feel like there are other canaries in the coal mine here. So,
sure.
Fun scientific observation with Owen time. stuff that, again, I don't tell the people abroad, but I really should probably start just...
Yeah, it's not like we do a weekly podcast or anything like that that you could, you know, bring down to the board or anything.
It's my info, you know, and data.
Not just like
myself. Anyway, Madagascar hognose.
Okay.
Yes.
Last year, I got eggs April 6th, and those right. eggs hatched on June 16th. So close to 60-day Python temp stuff. Okay. And I literally just put them in a bin with a bunch of moss and put them on the shelf.
Okay.
This year, I got a clutch. I'll get you the exact date.
Do you have a notebook or do you have a computer?
I have many things you're not privy to.
Well, I was just gonna
he drinks and notes. He knows things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's 100%.
You made fun of me forever for my notebook.
Shut
and
up.
And now you have adopted one more thing that I
The first clutch of Mad Hogs was March 19th.
There you go. Index okay. cards, right?
Those eggs are still eggs. They have not hatched. So last year, 60 days. This wow. year, March, damn. We're in June now. Still not hatched. Same thing. They look fantastic. They look great. They're in the same.
Have you candled them?
Yeah. Veins everywhere. Embryos, things are moving around in there. You they're sure not denting.
Is the incubator plugged in?
They're not in an incubator. They don't go in the incubator. They're in the same fucking bin I've hatched every Madagascar hognose ever in this house. Hmm. On the El same Nino. In the same spot.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe El Nino. I don't know.
So last year, 60 days. This year, fuck if I know.
If it goes longer, based on what we know about just generic incubation temps, when you go cooler, things take longer. Mm-hmm. Although El Nino from literature brings warmer storms, it also produces a longer, later winter system that goes mm-hmm. further into the year, which, you know, depending on where you're at and what's normal and what you're paying attention to, it's debatable. But I would think that, yeah, that could have some effect, especially if you're relying on ambience. Your ambience are staying probably a little bit lower, a little bit longer than last right. year.
And it's also weird because that clutch happened in March, and that's the earliest I've ever had a Madagascar
right. hognose clutch. Right.
So
yeah, I had a couple of years ago. I had a I don't know if it was this jungle or a different jungle, but she would lay consistently like almost a day. Mm-hmm. to the calendar day of when she laid, and then 1 year it was like 2 months, like a just full like
way out there
60 yeah. day cycle. And from what we know about, you know, equatorial species having like kind of like potentially that cycle that comes every 2 months in theory, I was wondering if maybe it was just like because of the storm systems or something environmentally, it just her body just said the next window, we're good. Mm-hmm. Let's jump to the next window. Let's push it a little bit more. And it just hit a cutoff where it's like next window. And so everything was just right in that regard, which makes me wonder, is that like a generational process of how we got Australian animals to breed in the northern hemisphere on the opposite calendar over time?
Yeah. Probably. But then also it's like, if I wasn't keeping the trios of hogs together, would he have been in there at the right time, being that it was a full month early before I was expecting?
Sure. I would think it would still have gone late.
Yeah.
I think it would still go late, but again, even if he was in there full time.
Of course, I'm saying this, and I haven't checked the bin today, but the weird thing about... The weird thing about colubrid eggs is like the denting that happens with a python egg. It's like the shell like dips a little bit and that's enough. And then out pops like a fully formed, pissed off Madagascar hog. So I don't know. I don't. Mm. Yeah. And I'll tell you right now, the other thing is that my rhinos are late as shit.
Yeah. One of the things that I read about El Nino it said, while limited data exists, certain reptiles and rodents depend on predictable rainfall patterns. Mm-hmm. Vertebrates too are likely to face challenges, particularly from invasive species thriving in wetter conditions. Generally though, most species thrive during El Nino due to a reprieve from drought because of the increased rainfall. But if they're used to us, you know, I think about, you know, at least in the wild, right? Mm-hmm. How El Nino would impact them if for whatever reason, they maybe it's those years where they're able to, you know, like double down because of the prey availability, as opposed to when the rainfall's not there, then the vegetation's not there, the invertebrates not there, the rodents aren't there, you know, those things aren't there. So maybe then, similar to what you were saying earlier, maybe the female, something clicks in her and says, wait till the next go around. Maybe that has to do with the amount of rainfall that happens.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
I'd be curious to see if there was some sort of explosion, successful breeding a year following El Nino, because like you were just saying, when we see El Nino, so if you break it down to like the real basic, like color, draw kids elementary school of what the environmental closed system is, you know, the rain comes, it creates the grass growth, which feeds the bugs, which feeds the the birds and the rodents and everything, which is what's predated upon by all the predators that we're speaking of. If you have a longer, later system of that, then in theory, maybe they have a good year of bulking up. And then the following season after an El Nino year is record breaking.
Right.
Maybe El Nino. Yeah. Some of them just don't go. Or some do the opposite. They capitalize on El Nino, and maybe things like Southeast Asian species or Boiga or, you know, something like that. Maybe those have a banner year during El Nino or like, Zonata, like Mountain Kings, things like that. Maybe,
right.
Maybe more arid, things, or I don't know. Maybe it's just certain ones benefit from it dramatically and some don't. And then maybe the opposite is true the following year. I'd be really curious to see.
Yeah, it would be interesting. I wonder if they've ever done studies about to that effect. Like maybe those, especially I think of desert species where it's super dry and then all of a sudden, you know, the floodgates open up and and life comes to the desert for that limited chunk of time. But maybe that's another reason why they're not necessarily breeding very often in the wild. But I think of rattlesnakes, though, and don't they watch those dens? And every year that there's baby rattlesnakes coming out of those dens.
But is it the same female every year? That's
well, I don't know. Yeah,
They have shown that rattlesnakes will use consistent den sites, but if there's a lot of flooding, it floods out those den sites. They're live bearing, so it doesn't necessarily kill clutches, but it can disperse them, and maybe that causes erratic laying behavior in places. But I would think after that point, the deed is done, and maybe it's just they just thrive in those conditions.
Yeah. But even then, the same four females go to the same den site year after year, and there are baby rattlesnakes. It's like, but is it the same? Like maybe, all four females having babies every year? Is it like this female this year, that female that next year? Like, I don't know.
Again, that's again, we're venturing to the unknown territory, right? But like, you know, think of that Secret Lives of Reptiles, and rattlesnakes were brought up many times in that book. Mm-hmm. You know, parental care and gardening.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe the reason why they have so many females at one den site is because they're able to help take care.
That's actually a very, you got to think about it. Every animal is their DNA is programmed to find the most advantageous and successful way to reproduce and survive based on where they're at. And if rain and a very seasonal moisture is limited, then yeah, you've got limited resources. So it makes sense for these communal animals to share those resources because it benefits the species and all of them. So that's why we see denning. That's why we see maternal care, even if it's not their offspring. So to me, it doesn't seem like too far of a stretch that maybe there's like an A, B, and a C group of females in a population that rotate, and you have a 3-year cycle where A group produces every 3 years, B group produces the next every 3 years, C group's producing the next every 3 years, and you come back to A group. And that way, resource sharing is kind of done in many, many factors.
I'll tell you right now that I had a harder time pulling the eggs away from the Vietnamese Blue Beauty than I did from any python last 2 years. Like, I mean, she was around them. She was biting. She didn't want me touching her. She didn't want me touching them. She was kinds of pissed. And the problem is with them is they're nothing but muscle, and they keep coming. It's like I'm 2 feet away. Well, maybe I'll get to the eggs at some point. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, it was insane. And I was not expecting that much of a maternal fight from a colubrid. Like, it was a colubrid.
Do they typically stay with their eggs?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I would bet
much about colubrids.
I would bet those guys, being Southeast Asian, they probably nest them somewhere in some dense vegetation that rots and stay nearby and do guarding things.
She was pissed. And
gotta get you a face shield and put a GoPro on you.
I mean, I did. I had Melissa with me, and I'm gonna hand you the eggs, and you just put them, and I'll deal with her. And she's like, well, hurry up. I'm like, I'm trying. Like, you know, don't look at me. Just go away. It's and with the, like a carpet python, we've all been there where it's just like, eggs. Like, it's like you just pick her up, put her down.
Yeah. Right. It,
these things, she was pissed. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, you're. And I guess that's my own stupidity of going into it thinking that she's going to be like a corn snake where I'm like, get out of here and just stomp up the eggs. Yeah. But no,
a little more than a corn snake.
A little bit more than a corn snake there, Owen. Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. To be fair, though, I mean, you're used to carpets. I can't even think of a time a female's ever bit me on eggs. So.
Yeah, thank you. Like, not especially not if you're paying attention. Like, I think the last time I got bit on eggs was when I saw her laying before I left, and then I was gone for the weekend. So she had 2 days to like move them in position and get herself under. Like, it's that whole thing. But again, it's like to think that there isn't some type of maternal protection over fresh eggs.
Mm.
Yeah,
I think any animal's going to do that.
You know, the other interesting thing I had written down as you guys were talking, you were talking about timing. Mm. The one thing that I took away from the interview we did with Dale about eggs was that, you know,
you can chicken.
We forget that like 35% of, you know, incubation happens inside the female. I think that was the number. It was like 35% of the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's not something that I ever thought about like that, if you would. Like, I don't know. I didn't think of eggs and like incubating eggs until they're on the ground. So I think for me, what I would take away for the slug thing, as we were winding down on time or whatnot, I got one other question and then whatnot. But I would pay very close attention to the male as far as temperature. I think that I would pay closer attention to the ability for that snake to thermoregulate within its environment. Perhaps that's why we get females that are wrapping bowls and stuff like that, because they're trying to cool down cooler than what we have, or that ambient spot away from the heat is not a cool enough. So the, like, you need a, like, whereas like the, you know, like your ambient may be, let's say 80, and then your hot spot may be like 87, let's say, during the breeding time, maybe they have to be, you know, you still stay at the 87 for the ambient, but the, you know, that this one goes down a bit so that they have access to those lower temperatures, if you will.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know if it would matter or not, but
at this point, I like, the problem is that when you look at breeding, when you're first doing it, is like, it's like stages. This is the pairing stage, and this is the egg stage, and this is the baby stage, where it's like when you get older and get into it more, you're like, it never stops. Okay. It is a constant stream of shit that you have to do, but it just depends on what you're paying attention to. Like, right now is you're like, we're gearing up, because then August you start feeding. And then you're going to start doing this other stuff. And then you start doing this other stuff. And then, oh, yeah, eventually you'll pair in like February, but you better start planning it now. And that's what gears up for success. You plan in August for eggs in, you know, March. So
I remember Nick saying that you have to think about a female for 2 years before you breed in her. What you're doing to her for that length of time is going to, you know,
are
you success or not success?
I got a new Brisbane female. And
is that girl from Morph Market?
Yes.
Okay.
Nice. Yes.
Yeah.
Nice.
She's gorgeous.
Glad you got it.
She's a small head. She's gorgeous, small head. Ooh. So I'm like, all right, I want a mature, beefy coastal head. So this is a large rat.
Big meals.
Yeah, like, just eat it. Just, I'm just throwing food at her and she's eating everything. And it's like, this is the plan so that she's ready to go. But that's one of those game time decisions where it's like, it's time to start putting down. It's time to start pairing. And if she just still doesn't look mature for me, I'm probably going to push it off.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to go. The Kribos taught me that in a big way, because I got my best, healthiest looking clutch from the start on my first clutch, because she essentially had 4 full calendar years to devote to it. Even though, you know, the times afterwards, debatably, I either didn't give her enough or overfed or somewhere in between. But I think, you know, for a first animal, a female's first clutch, everything from hatch makes a huge difference. Like, even if she goes off food for 6 months within, you know, her still juvenile stages, that pushes you back a year. And that I think needs to be taken into consideration. So yeah, it would make sense that even after a first clutch, then you need to look at every window of 2 years after that as what's capable. Even if she breeds back to back to back years, you also got to factor in that's probably shortening the lifespan. So that's, I mean, something that has to be taken into account.
I mean, we've constantly said the most dangerous thing you could possibly do to a female animal is attempt to breed it. And
100%. Yeah.
And this year is that case in point for me, because as I lost my adult female Chinese king, and it's like that set that project back to one, like we're restarting.
Yeah. Because I had 3 consecutive years of a female passing away, Papuan jungle. And it's just, and if you think about it in the numbers, it's a very, very small percentage of all of this, right? Well, but at the same time, it's a bigger percentage of what's producing,
right?
And it sets certain things back,
right?
And there's probably things in the 2 year window beforehand that were involved.
Yeah. Right. And, but then there's also things of like, I lost my female pine snake and I scrapped the whole project rather than keep chasing it and build and rebuilding it and stuff like that. I'm done. So in certain aspects, we kind of find ourselves lucky because every once in a while something goes wrong, but we got enough carpet pythons, something will slide right in. You can kind of get in there and kind of like hit it a bunch with a hammer and it kind of works. Like, you got a friend, you're like, hey, I need that. And you're like, all right, come get it. Like, and then, but in other stuff, that's the end of the project right there with
right. No, and that's exactly why I'm like mentally ready to move on from Kribos after 11 years is because unless I had a colubrid room that I was designing to run like Central America.
Right.
And was only doing like Central American colubrids and boas.
Yeah.
That would be fine.
Right.
But you know, I was really pushing the parameters with what my carpets could handle over the last few years for a few other side projects, and the carpets handled it, but the other projects, it was like either not enough or just wasn't working. And it's really reinforced that old saying. Well, it's old to me. I've come up in this space hearing that, you know, eventually it's going to catch up to you that if you're trying to do different species in one room from different parts of the world, it's just not going to gel all the time. Right. And I've been very lucky. You know, I had a lot of success for like 10 years with rainbow boas and carpets and other things like that. So I got lucky with a few things, but yeah, it's just the reality is really set in there.
So I wonder if the carpets that you're doing kind of fall into that parameter of the, like, you know, the rainbow boa and a carpet python aren't necessarily from too big of a difference of a spot.
Latitudinally?
It was the same latitude, dramatic. Different longitudes.
Right. Yeah. Not very dramatic. Yeah.
It reminds me of
some subtle niche habitat variation. Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of Justin was on, I know this was weeks ago, but he was on TRL and he was talking about Antaresia. And the one thing that he brought up is that he's bred spotted pythons, but they're sort of like hit or miss for him. Whereas like the Western stims, you know, he's like dialed them in, like he produces them like in his sleep. It's kind of how he's saying it, right? So like, and then what you have is the reverse of that with, I forget who was the other person he was talking about, but they're having really good, and they were on the East Coast, I believe, are having really good success with the spotted pythons, but not so much with the Stimson's pythons. And I think of just those two animals, right? You think Antaresia, you kind of think, I don't know, in my brain, I always kind of, even though I know that they're from different environments, I just sort of thought that they were from the same basic type of environment, right? But you got one that's basically living in the desert, right? Where Justin's basically living in the desert.
Right.
And, you know, you have one that's living in, you know, in Queensland and in, you know, it's
which
probably
makes
not
more sense.
Yeah,
they're a lot more melanistic. There's a lot more black to them. You get a lot more black in the stripe. That totally just clicked for me. They're like the diamonds of the Antaresia.
Yeah. So maybe the fact that, yes, you'll be able to breed them, but you're not going to, like there's certain species that we all have that we just have dialed in that you could just breed without even thinking about. Then there's those other ones to where they're outside of our box per se. And like maybe the fact that you'll get clutches from them, but you're not going to be able to quit your day job in knowing that.
Sure.
If you're all keeping in one room, that
right.
I don't know how you two in particular keep all the fucking things that you keep straight. Well,
because Riley and I have the same thing.
When you feed and when your temperatures are dropping,
Riley and I have the same thinking. Feed
every other day, and it's like, what the
so Riley's got it the same. And Riley took me to school on several things when it came to this kind of thinking.
Yeah,
and it was that you have the set basis of what your room is capable of.
Yeah.
And then there are a shit ton of species from around this planet that will do fantastic in that little.
But I don't want that species.
But that's the thing is like, but that's, you'd be surprised what species will fit into that little biosphere.
That's why it suits Owen and it doesn't suit you, Eric.
Yes.
Owen is at in his heart. He's a Gemini like me.
Damn.
He's sadomasochistic to himself. Yeah. He's a glutton for punishment. He doesn't want to ever have a second to sit down on the couch with nothing to do.
Right.
Exactly. Chaos is what he thrives on.
This is also
the broken glass from retics is debatably from the retics, right?
Yeah.
But that's the thing. Like he's got that hunger for it. And he's always kind of trying to learn it and understand it more. And he's just a busy squirrel.
Yeah. Right, because you can have the fun where it's like,
it is,
I have
fun.
Shit from Madagascar breeding in the same room with shit from Australia, with shit from Vietnam.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. Like, I get it. Like, I always thought it was sweet that I could, like, hatch carpets anywhere from, like, April, May to, like, June.
You just and keep going.
Go straight into rainbow boas and then straight into, you know, and just, like, boom, just never stop. And then like, have it at work. And, like, I get why also people don't want that, too.
Right. I mean, last year when it was like carpet clutch and then, you know, Chinese king rat clutch and then another carpet clutch and then Madagascar hognose, pine snake, rhino, rough scale. It was like it just kept going and things overlapped and it just kind of seems where it goes. So having the idea of what your room is capable of, that's your main thing. You can find stuff that fit in there and do very well.
You build off that.
Yeah, my fun is that technically I have one room that has this little biosphere and I have another room like that has its own little biosphere over here.
Sure.
And I got another room that I can fuck with. So when you got multiple stuff, you can kind of see it works out. The white lips work better in the back room.
Yes.
Because, and so do the olive pythons, because that's where I got eggs. So,
yeah, I guess in theory, I could keep rhino rats in this room with the diamond
rhino rats upstairs in the living room.
Yeah. What I'm saying is like, this is a colder room.
Yes.
And that's a warmer room over there. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, you know,
I had to right now the rhino cage in the living room is inaccessible due to the kitten paddock. There is a kitten paddock.
Furry landmine.
So,
good Lord.
But I did manage to get in there today. And like I said, this is a new female in that cage that I am hesitant to be like, I caught a couple locks, but I'm nervous. So this is the first time for her. And she's on loan from a friend. And, you know, he couldn't get her to go. And I feel them. I think they're in there, but we'll see.
Let's talk about that too. Yeah. Like, we definitely see some apprehension or taking a year off when we do breeding loans, right? Like sometimes you do a breeding loan and you anticipate that first year being the first go. And sometimes she just wants to go to the next year. And sometimes that's the norm. I mean, honestly, I kind of anticipate that. Like I got lucky with the albino Darwin that's on loan, but like, I was like, nah, she's probably not going to go this year. It's probably next year, which is fine. She'll have been here less than a calendar year, like
eating,
but you know, settling in, and I could still see like figuring out routine. I don't know. Like, she decided to produce and I attribute that to her being a proven breeder, but you know, had she not been, probably wouldn't have been the case.
I think all animals that you're going to breed need to be where they're going to be by August.
Yeah.
So
if,
I'm probably thinking,
that's a good way.
Right.
Yeah.
Where it's that's like a good rule of thumb.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking to a friend. I'm like, hey, we should do breed loan. Okay. I want it ready and in my house by August, and then I will make – that gives me all of August and September for it to figure out what's going on, and then I can make the choice to turn the spigot off when food happens in October.
I wonder, too, how much that has to do with – because I used to be a proponent of just because of my experience and even just hearing it from when I was coming up in reptiles, you know, it's like a no-no, like you're not going to breed. Why even waste your time? It's not going to happen. And obviously they were, the people that I were talking to was really geared towards ball pythons and not different species. So I imagine it's different from species to species, but maybe if you adapt the same type of, like, I think of Nick, right? He's sending you an animal. I would assume that we're all kind of keeping in that same parameter of how Nick keeps, right? So it's not really outside of the norm. Whereas, and you're on the West Coast still. So it's, I mean, I know you're really far apart, but.
But I follow the same rules of thumb.
Right.
I've learned, I've literally learned from you guys, Nick, like the majority of the people I've learned from come from Maryland, New Jersey, you know, like upper Northeast. So,
So maybe the fact that if Nick sent that same animal, say, to the East Coast, maybe the transition would have to be a little bit longer or, you know, I don't know. Just the thought
How many times have you and I traded?
Maybe you guys are just in tune. Like, if you're really in tune with your collection and really paying attention to it, which you guys must be because of what you're producing, right? So, like, you're paying attention to little things that you don't even know that, like, I think that's the fascinating thing for me with keeping snakes, right? And that's sort of where I'm at. It's like, I know you guys are keeping multiple different things, but I like want to learn everything I can about that one topic, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, to me, it's like really understanding pythons. It's like two things. One, there was this YouTube video that I watched the other day. It's called Inside Nature's Giants. And I've seen this before where they dissected a giraffe, which was fucking fascinating.
Oh, yeah, I love that stuff. Yeah.
But they did a Burmese python. And to like see somebody actually doing a dissection of a Burmese python to see what the insides look like, to see that lung, that little tiny lung and the real big lung. And you're just
the level of understanding.
Yeah, man, it's just, just even they're like, they cut off some of the skin. Right. And they were showing about how loose the scales are. And that the reason that they have that elasticity is because of the big meals that they would buy. They also showed about the mechanics of how they, when they're crawling along, which, like, I don't know. I never really, the muscles, there's two layers of muscles and they go different ways. And the one pulls and the one pushes. And
I mean, they're like, they're like an X cross. And then you got the rib cage and then the fat stores.
I've read all that stuff.
It's
read
fascinating.
But when you're actually see, I'm a visual person. And when it visually, I'll send you guys the link to this after.
Dude, those I've seen those dissections because they do an elephant and a whale and stuff like that. They're fascinating. There's apparently there's like I think it's like a tendon or a vein or something that goes from like our heart up here and stuff like that, and it makes a U shape because at one point we were like a fish and it just was a straight line, and then as we grew it kind of did this little thing and in the giraffe it's the same, it's just it's like really fucking long. It's like shit, like, and it's watching somebody grab that and walk, and he's like, and we're still going, we're still following it, and he goes like down the room and down back.
Dude,
like
I've seen I've seen a giraffe necropsy in person.
Oh, really? Like
when I was a
That's wild.
Bro, it was hectic. Like, it, obviously, you know, it was a delicate situation, but the animal's head was, you know, as big as me. Its heart was 25 pounds. The cavity of the animal couldn't fit in this room right here. I mean, like, just to see that in person and just the amount of biomass when it's really up close and personal, and then to see the intricacies of how it works. And I got to go to University of Florida and see down in their wet lab and see a lot of different things. And they had like a rearticulated berm skeleton in a big circle, and got to pull like 8 foot indigos out of the, you know, the formula and stuff that's in the drawers, and like, look at all this stuff. And when you get to really look at that stuff, it's pretty freaking amazing. I mean, that's got to dissect, I got to dissect an alligator, like a big adult male that had passed away.
Oh shit.
And, for croc school.
That's awesome.
That was a part of my herpetology class in college. We did a rattlesnake. And I'm like, it's this is like, amazing. I'm having
once so you
fun.
Get into that. Yeah, I've personally skinned a rattlesnake that an old boss of mine killed. Crazy story. And just out of curiosity, it was like pinning it out and tanning the skin and like looking at all the insides.
God, was that annoying. I did that for a carpet.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's really, I don't know. That's so like, that's why my brain doesn't, like, I'm so focused on that one thing, like trying to learn about this one group of snakes that sometimes it's good to step outside of that, which is why I listen to podcasts that talk about other snakes that give me ideas and stuff. But anyway,
especially when it comes to fertility and reptiles, because there is like, I've spent, I don't know how much time trying to find anything I can on fertility and pythons, infertility, anything like that. And the best you get is discussions and a little bit of analysis of their reproductive tract and that's probably it here and there.
Yeah. Right. Well, the one, I'll end this on this, but like the one cool thing about that snake was that it was a wild snake that they found in the Everglades, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of fat bodies in this snake was nuts. And
they are efficient.
Yeah, I think about like, is a big snake like that that's only eaten meals so often, are they different than, say, a smaller python that doesn't have to store as much? You know what I mean? Like, you know, we kind of all think of them the same, but like for a big snake like that that's coming from a spot where, you know, we all know those African rocks and whatnot that are eating a gazelle like, once a year, you know what I mean? Maybe twice a year or something like that. But, you know, I would imagine that a lot of that has to do with, you know, a lot of that particular species maybe storing that fat has to do with the fact of just their size.
So on that note, a lot of what I was finding that did even have any sort of threat or relevance, I was finding interesting, and it stood out to me, where there's several references, and it wasn't species specific. It was just kind of like generic snakes in general can do this. There was a lot of reference about, and it almost made it seem like it was a conscious decision, and it's not the same way we perceive control or deciding, making decisions, but there was like a reference to these animals can somewhat, I guess to put it in a way that makes sense to us, they can decide how to allocate their fat resources, how to, there's some sort of mechanism of control and decision, like, okay, this is good, maybe not. There's like decision making that is different than conscious, and it's like they can decide when to do these things, and that probably has a lot of other factors going into it, like the genetic, El Nino, the genetic lineage, prey availability, stress, different things like that. Like, you know, you got to also take into effect, there's probably, you know, just like within people and other animals, there's highs and lows on the spectrum. So there's probably smaller individuals that are capable of hitting it off and figuring it out right away and not needing as much resource allocation and therefore probably don't have slugs. Like, you know, so we often talk about Papuans breeding just fine, being on the smaller side. Maybe that's advantageous for some species. And then you get into things like berms and retics where maybe there isn't a limit for some, and they can just push out as many fertile eggs as their mass can handle. But they're probably like the exception. Like if you map all, you know, ophidians or all snakes and all squamates on like a, on a, you know, they're probably the exception to that bell curve. But
yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah,
I just got to think, because, you know, we talk about fat females not breeding or fat males being lazy breeders. Yeah. That's the far end of the spectrum, right? Right. There's a happy medium somewhere, and maybe within every species that range varies. And so some just don't have a limit. Like we've seen record clutches of berms, like 100-egg clutches, and same thing with retics and mainlands. You can just really push some of those animals. Same thing with sulcata tortoises or, I don't know. I just, some animals are built for it and some aren't. Like the same way chameleons are such an anomaly that most chameleons are built for fast, heavy, and die as quick as possible, because you're just not going to do it. You're just going to produce as much as possible at 9 months old and then on and just burn out fast.
Yeah,
it's on the opposite ends of extremes.
I would imagine like, that. I
feel like some animals pump out that many babies because not many, like it's sea turtle logic. I'm going to lay 200 because maybe one will make it. Like it's kind of that whole thing. So, but in certain aspects, like I have some carpets, so I can't keep weight on them. Like they're just skinny as a rail, eat everything in sight. And they just, for whatever reason, they're never going to get huge. On that,
probably
other
side, a good thing.
It is so much better, especially because it's a boy that does this to me, and I'm like, you're fine. Yeah, but on the other side is I have a female that was huge when I bred her, and then when I scaled her down, she lost a lot of that body fat, but she still maintains. She's a big animal.
Have you ever bred her since then?
Nah, Trinity, I let her ride. I mean, I think the last
couple, which I don't blame you.
I think 2-3 years ago was the last time I bred her, and I got a good turnout of eggs, but it was not
any slugs.
I had tons of slugs. I never got her. It wasn't her high level. She was 32, 33 eggs a clutch. I think the last one I got was like in the teens. And
maybe there's something to be said for like you push them too far, and even if you try and bring them back, you've done irreparable.
It's a rubber band, you know.
But then there's probably age involved too.
I think of you know, you said about clutch size, and I would imagine that has to do with the environment that they're from and the amount of prey that. Or the type of prey, to your point, Owen, if it's a sea turtle and it's laying 100 eggs because one's going to make it because they got to get past the snakes and then they got to get past the birds. Then they got to get past. Yeah, you know what I mean? There's all these factors that come to play that forces that female to lay a bigger clutch.
They have to hope to God to get into the water where the sharks are a problem.
There's a gauntlet before the gauntlet.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. Really figure anything out when it comes
to
slugs.
We were never gonna.
I enjoy those type of conversations, so I appreciate
it. I will say this year, to bring it back to slugs.
Yeah.
Okay.
This year for me personally has been my biggest learning year.
Okay.
And the record number of slugs. I have tallied 61 slugs.
Okay.
And I think I only aimed for 9 pairings, and I think I got 8 potentially of those. So like, as far as success goes, getting pairings to produce something pretty normal or above average, but the slug thing has been remarkable for me. And I just recently surpassed that. Okay. With the last clutch. So I'm in the green as far as that goes, but not by much. And so some of the animals that have produced a lot of the slugs, some of them are new to producing slugs, and some of them are, it's not their first time. And like the Crebo has been a repeat thing. The corn snake, that was a new thing, but then like the coastal clutch, that was new. That was a new animal for slugs. Now, granted, I could probably chalk that up to a very young, small male, and maybe not feeding her quite as much as I would have liked, like a little bit less. So like there's some little factors in there that I'm not going to like disregard, right? That have some bearing on me and my performance or the animals in my care, whether it be young or, you know, they just came off of like 2 consecutive seasons or whatever it is. But I just can't help but notice that all of this is happening all on the same year as a big El Nino season. And that I can't find any research that supports that. All I can find is people having anecdotal sort of seems to line up, but we don't quite understand it yet. It's never black and white. There's never just one variable at play. There's too many variables at play when you're talking biological entities, whatever it be. So yeah, we're not going to solve this issue. Anybody who's listening with a notepad going like, okay, how to avoid
any minute
slugs?
Now they're going to tell me. Yeah.
Here's the secret. Feed to breed. You can do everything right and you're still going to throw stuff away. So it's just the nature of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, that's the thing about breeding, right? Everybody thinks it's all glorious and all, and everything is great.
Until it teaches you a lot though. It teaches you a hell of a lot about yourself, Yeah. About your resiliency, about your animals, about how much you really care about what you're doing. And if you can survive 61 slugs, that's like getting shot with three full banana clips of paintballs. That's just like having a mag dump on you twice. Just like, right. Hit me.
It also lay it on me. How many rocks you need to put in your pocket to hold yourself underwater. Like,
yeah,
there's a lot
probably
of that
fewer
kind of
than that. Yeah. And if you can get through that, you love it. And you just
right. It's like we said, breeding season is nothing but, you know, stellar freaking highs and gut punching lows. And you know what? If you can find a way to have more highs than lows, it's a good season.
Yeah.
You know,
it's always a good season when you can do that. And ultimately, yeah. if you walk away with healthy animals and, you know, even nothing to show for it, but animals are okay, then that's
kind of why I try to adopt the whole thing of that. I'm just a crazed man throwing jello at the wall, and I refuse to believe that there's like that I have anything to do with this other than pure dumb luck, because people are like, you're killing it, come back and eat it. We'll see what I'm doing. Like, it's like, I don't know. I feel like that's the best way to kind of roll with it.
You take the good with the bad, you collect data and information and insight where you can, you learn where you can, and you also get kicked in the shins and humbled where you can, reminded that you don't know everything. Like,
yeah,
good Lord, Brettles pythons are going to be the training wheel snake for me if I've ever had one. So
some people just might have one thing where it just, again, maybe your biosphere that you've set up is not conducive for that one thing. And or maybe your pair are just a bunch of assholes, like, and you got to shift it up.
It'll be interesting to look back on collectively this sort of anecdotal data, maybe like 5 years from now, and see like, okay, have I been able to repeat that with the same animals, other animals so far and so forth. So
to be honest, I prefer the pairs where it's like with the Blue Beauties, I tried like for 3-4 years and now I got a clutch. Yeah. It's almost like when it happens the first time out, I'm like, well, all right, I get, I mean,
it doesn't mean the same.
You didn't
have to work as hard.
I'm happy, right. But I'm not rough scale 10 years of beatings happy. Like, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's the thing that I always equate to El Nino with this stuff is, I heard Nick on Reptile Radio in 2009. And he said he was having the worst season that he ever had. This is even before I knew who Nick Mutt was.
Right. That actually, 2009, they say it happens every 7 or so years. So
there
that,
you go.
I just looked it up just to verify. El Nino happened in 2009.
There you
summer
go.
Of 2009. It was so it was like going into that season, the whole he was so it was like 2009, 2010, if you will. Yeah.
That makes sense.
I remember him saying that, and I was like, oh man, wow, I have to watch for this now too. What the hell?
Yeah.
So I at this point, there's no evidence of it, but it just seems as one of those weird things that maybe one day we'll have figured out.
I smell a t-shirt in the making.
Yeah.
I still want to get
El Nino. I blame El Nino. And then put the image of Chris Farley from the skit from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
I am El Nino.
There you go.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
T-shirts.
I guess we'll wrap it up there. Yeah, right. I know we're close on time, but as always, Riley, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Glad to have the conversation.
Thank you guys for having me on. I'm glad something good came out of my 61 slugs this year.
Yeah, I have to
always look at the
labels
positive,
off
man.
These. Yeah,
always hey, look man, at the positive. You know,
there's a silver lining everywhere. There really is. You know, and I'm not kidding, man. Like, this has been as far as if I just put the blinders on and only looked at the bad numbers, right? Only looked at the certain columns of statistics, right? This would be my worst year, hands down. But if I just open those blinders a little bit and go, well, I also have like 70, 80 eggs of this and checked off this species and checked off this species and working on this. And it's just like, you know, everything is in perspective, even outside of just the year. Look at the last 10 years, you know, like if your graph ain't going up and you're not having fun, you know, change something. But at the end of the day, like, you go to bed, you wake up, and the bad stuff goes away, and maybe you're in a different frame of reference, and you just got to keep going because these animals are worth it. They're so much fun, man. Like,
yeah,
I couldn't imagine my life without them. They teach me so much, and I'm just so grateful for being able to, like, be their steward and share it with people, you know? Like, this is rad, dude. Like, we live pretty freaking wild lives. Like, if you went through the average person's cell phone, like, photo album and anyone else, and, like, we're living extremely crazy lives.
Yeah.
And I think we take that for granted. So I love my snakes. I love the community that we have. And even through the failures, we still have a good time. Like, look at us, you know, making good conversation and informative talk about slugs. Like, the things that people clearly don't even want to talk about or publish. Like, I think you could probably find more information on YouTube about me getting slugs this year than has ever been published prior. So you're welcome.
Yeah, you talk about crazy lives. I think I always tell people at work, you know, oh, I'm going on this herp trip. And I come back and we're like, oh, we hiked for, you know, I think the one hike we did was like 14 miles. And they're like, what?
What? You went on vacation.
Vacation. And we're like, it was awesome.
Yeah. And we come away from that not thinking like, oh, God, I can't believe I walked that. You come away from like, even if you don't get anything, you're like, man, I got to go back. I got to do it again. I got to go back for that animal. Yeah, and at the very least, you have a great time with the people around you. And I don't know if there's anything else out there in the world that can bring people together like reptiles. So we're all very fortunate in that regard. So
yeah,
slug on.
Yeah.
100%. Well, hopefully next year we all have great success and no slugs.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, you know what? Slugs
happen.
That's the way I see it, you know? Slugs happen. Humble, right? I smell another t-shirt.
Another t-shirt. Slugs happen.
Slugs happen.
Yeah.
They keep you humbled and make you appreciate when you do have success, right?
Like I said, it feels so much better when you get that one. Like, right, your coastal clutch, that was the hypo?
Yeah.
Imagine, like, maybe next year or the year after that when you hit
and if he proves out to be a super.
See that thing. Again,
cartwheels.
It just makes it better. It just makes it so much better.
Exactly. The scale always weighs itself out.
It just makes it so much better. These are mine.
Yes. I have studied your success with white lips and rough scales and everything in between. So I'm here playing the patient game. And
you have to.
I sold my soul to the Morelia Devil a long time ago. And I'm okay with it.
Did I have
it? You were born with it.
Oh, yeah. One Riley soul. Yeah, I do have that.
Yep. It happened.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of it. And Oh, and we've still got a nice, potentially fun clutch of womas at work going. Womas. So I get to tease.
That's that crazy woma.
That's that other one.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, so like, crazy. I'm really excited about that because this will be redemption for the other clutches. So we'll see if other wacky reduced pattern animals come out of there, which if they do, I'm definitely taking home one.
Heck yeah, man.
Again,
that snake is wild looking. That's really
add cool. Womas. It's like when in doubt, just add something else to the sphere. Yeah, you go. Yep.
I got two of them right here.
There you go.
There you go.
I need more. The Australian stuff works for me.
Yeah.
It's in your sphere.
Yeah.
It's in my sphere. And I've just been slowly admitting to myself more and more that the sphere needs to be a little more of a tight circle and less of a globe.
I had the idea of breeding all the pythons, and then I was like, I had this when I was herping with Nick and Ryan, and I was sitting there and I was going, I said, you know what? I said, Ryan, you're already doing all the pythons. I don't need to do that.
Yeah.
And to do that and not be a full-time breeder is probably really difficult. However, I can do all of the Australian. So the idea is to herp, breed, and keep all of the Australian pythons.
There you go.
There's your
contribution to the sector of it all, right? And
the legal
and somebody stuff. Else inevitably will pick that up and see that, and they're going to pick their slice of the pie adjacent to it and do their thing. And there's always going to be overlap, and generations will come and go and involve, and it'll just be a big pizza pie.
Yeah, man.
Pizza pie and pythons.
Mm-hmm. Another t-shirt.
Hey.
Damn it. Too many.
Yeah. All right, for the people that don't know, Riley, because you recently just started doing something new on your YouTube channel, which I really dig, that new species of snake that you were talking about on that little short thing you did with the clip in the news.
Yeah, so
that was cool,
so,
man. I liked it.
I've been trying to come up with creative ways to get more people engaged with reptiles, whatever that may be. You know, we always talk about reaching the 99% versus preaching to the 1%, which is us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if you really kind of just look at what everybody else pays attention to in sort of social media form, it's short form content right now. And if you just Google reptiles in the news, chances are you can find stuff within the last week that's somewhat relevant to some county. And you can just make a quick little clip and just throw it up, superimpose something, and you can sort of just do it. And I just realized I'm just going to do this. There's relevant news that comes up every so often. My dad literally sends me links all the time because like he's getting it from people. And right. So like, why not take that? Because if everybody's getting it, why not take it and make it so that everybody gets it with a fun little spin of, you know, maybe some relatable education and maybe like thread a hair of conservation into that, or just somehow make it more palatable so people aren't thinking, oh my God, there's a water monitor there. They're like, oh my gosh, what does that mean? There's a pet industry and what is going on? These don't belong here. They're what? And so they start thinking and Googling, and it kind of just engages a different part of the brain. And I was like, well, that's a low commitment thing for me. That's like a low energy. I can just do that literally on the fly on my phone and just cross pollinate it quickly, easily. I've seen other people do it quick, fun, easy, committed, super easy. And then, the other thing I want to do is, I want to film some segments where I go through, photos on my phone that I don't publish and put out there. Cause there's a lot of stuff that we don't share publicly because it's just not like Instagram worthy or just doesn't fit content vibes, or maybe it's behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
And you can just do some cool talking photos about that. Because like I said earlier, we've all lived some pretty ridiculous lives just because of what reptiles have opened for us, you know?
Right. You don't think about it until you start talking to people, and then I'm like, well, yeah, I've been to Australia and Alaska.
Yeah. No, and think about
it. Yeah. All right.
About it. Like, imagine if I just literally like every 2 weeks, just had a video that came out where I went through like 5 to 10 photos of my phone and just talked about like, okay, I was in Florida when this happened. I did some crazy shit here. I did this. This is what this was. This is what this was. And then it was just like, it's just extra information for people that aren't maybe exposed. And like, maybe you guys might not get a kick out of it because like I said, we're sort of in that world. We're literally flipping through our phones. We all have the same photos of us.
I mean, we could have been standing next to you when that happened. Yeah,
exactly. So maybe that, like, maybe the 1%, the related people like us might just like quickly flip through it and give it a like and, hey, great one, cool, and pass it on. And that's cool for the algorithm. But then the 99% of people that are like getting fed random stuff, And they have no idea what's coming their way. They're gonna be like, wait a minute, I've been there. Wait a minute, what is this guy talking about? What is that? Right. What is that? That's really cool. And all of a sudden there's just this new window into some of that. And it, even if it just touches like a handful of people in that, it could snowball into something ridiculous. And it's not a selfish pursuit for me. It's like, I'm constantly looking for more things to do because like I said earlier about Owen, we're gluttons for punishment. We just literally can't not have projects to do.
Yeah.
And so I'm like constantly like, well, I have all these animals around me. I have all this stuff to share that every time I'm just like, I was just visiting with my brother, we're playing golf, and his neighbor was like, wait a minute, you breed snakes and you sell and ship them? You went to crocodile school? What? I mean, like, I know I could sit down and bury this dude and just have his jaw drop with information for like 24 hours worth of content just off of photos in my phone, you know?
Right.
And I'm sure every one of us could do the same. And so it just kind of hit me the other day, like, I should just, you know, talk about this and put it out for the people to see, because it's just, it's fun. It's amazing information. It's, even if it's not for, like I said, you and I get hate from other people in the reptile community, I don't care, because like, the rest of the people that might never know that St. Augustine alligator farm existed, or they didn't know anything about AZA accredited zoos, they didn't know anything about you know, all what field herping is or all these other things that we take for granted as just normal, it could really do a lot. Mm-hmm. And I mean, shit, skateboarding is in the Olympics now. And I grew up being like posed by people for skateboarding, you know what I mean? So like things change. And I feel like it's hard to see when change is happening. It's really easy to see it after the fact. And right now we're in change.
Yes.
And I would rather be a part of it. I'd rather be a part of the change that I would love to see more community involvement. I would love to see more acceptance of reptiles, and it is becoming more accepted. So I feel like it's just one more way for me to do my part, and it's been fun.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. And it's that fun aspect where it's like, you talk to people and it's like, oh, well, I was here looking at this and looking for that. And they're like, you went to this part of Pennsylvania and you found these. Oh yeah. And I didn't really have to go that far off the beaten path. You'd be surprised how close oh my you are gosh. To
yeah.
a lot of things. Yeah. It's like, it's kind of like the peeling back the layer, and you are that weird person that, you know, other people work with, and it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's
100%. I've owned that for decades. I'm fine.
You at least work in a reptile shop where it's like a little bit better. Like Eric and I have to talk to normies all day, and it's like, you know.
Yeah, I get that a lot. Yeah.
I get spotted at the grocery store. Hey, that's the reptile guy. Don't mind me, my dandelion greens.
I get spotted at the grocery store. That's the snake guy.
Yeah, you work.
Even though I don't work at it, they just know me as a snake
guy. Yeah, yeah.
Weirdo. But yeah.
Right.
And you start talking to them, and they're like, what? So awesome stuff. Riley Reptiles is the YouTube channel.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yeah. Riley's Reptiles. Everything's Riley's Reptiles.
Awesome.
I think YouTube, it might just be Riley Jimison, but yeah, I'm easy to find. You can find me on everything.
Okay, cool. All the links will be in the show notes and all that, so check it out. All right. Awesome. Thanks, Riley. Much appreciated. Yeah. And
appreciate you, fellas.
Have fun at the game.
Yeah.
Oh, I will.
Whatever team you want to win, we'll win. And
you know what? I'm there to have a good time. It's local. There's great food. The wife and I get to go out for a while. I'll come back and do some snake feeding tonight. Life is good, man.
Win-win.
I've made my life good, and so can everybody else. So
there you go.
You know, all you need is a dash of reptiles and have some fun.
Yeah. Right on.
Perfect. All right, fellas.
All right, man.
All right, thanks, Riley.
All right, we'll talk to you. We'll close this out.
Appreciate you.
Yeah.
Later.
All right. Let's see.
Announcements.
Yes. All right. If you want to support the show, here's some ways you can. Follow us on Moraine Python Radio and NPR Network on the socials. You can subscribe and share the podcast. That always helps get the word out. Check out the rest of the podcast that we have on the network. Lots of cool stuff hitting all kinds of different topics, from colubrids to monitors to Australia, perspectives, boas, all that stuff. So I will say that we were off. So the way that I'm going to do this is we're going to be off this week.
Yep.
I'm going to release the two shows the following 2 weeks because me and Owen will be away. I'll be in Utah and Owen will
be. I'll be in Ohio. Yeah.
Ohio. So, but no fear. Once we're back from that, I think our summer is pretty steady. And then as far as some of our sponsors, we got Cold Blooded Caffeine. Check out those if you're into coffee. Trey and McKendrick, they do a great job. Glad to be affiliated with them. You can use the code NPR10. You get 10% off your order, and we get a little kickback from it. We do have Carpets and Coffee blend, but there's plenty of stuff delicious. You can choose from. Very, very good stuff that you can check it out. And then we also have another cold-blooded thing, Owen.
We have a lot of cold-blooded things, but it is Cold-Blooded Cafe, where you can get your rodents. You can put in code NPR20 to get 20% off of your first order. If you have used the previous code, you have been reset and can use it again. Also, you can use FS250 to get free shipping off any order over $250. If you're anything like me, you could very easily get an order over $250.
Hey, yeah, me too.
Jesus Christ. So,
and I don't even have that big of a collection.
I know. So you can do that. Great food. It's the feeders that Eric and I use. And no complaints ever. Great packed and
100%
always good stuff. I have to put in an order, but I'm waiting until we get back from Ohio. I fed everybody this past weekend, and I'm like, I will put in an order when I get back. So I'll let you know when I'm going to do that.
Yep. Yeah. We'll have to make that happen.
I know so much crap, dude. No,
you can also, go ahead.
Anything no, but that's else? It. That's all I got for them.
You can also check out our website, MorelliPythonRadio.com. If you want to email us, MorelliPythonRadio@gmail.com. You can check out our merch store, and then we also have a Patreon that you can check out. So,
and this will be for the, this is coming out next week.
Yeah, I think I'm going to release this one first and then the Mac lots after.
Hamburg is June 8th. I will be there. I will be vending. I will have fun things like rough scale pythons and olive pythons and various carpet pythons, as well as some mad hogs and Chinese king rats and rhinos. I'm going to have all cool shit. June 8th, Hamburg. And I may be vending next to Mr. Matt Minatola. I'm not 100% sure on that, but if I am, I will be having fun.
The two horsemen ride again.
Yeah, that'll be a fun day. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, you know. So, yeah.
But Hamburg is now in a different spot, Owen.
It is in Morgantown, Pennsylvania.
Morgantown.
Do not go to Hamburg looking for reptiles on June 8th. You will be thrown out.
I mean, I think most people know that, but
I believe it's a car dealership now. Don't go there. But yeah, it's in the Morgantown Expo Center. If you go on the websites, which is the Northern Berks Reptile Expo or the Hamburg Reptile Expo, you'll be able to find it, their Facebook page, and look at your directions over there. But yeah, hopefully I'll see people there. It'll be a fun time.
Yeah, cool. And if Matt's bringing any of his short tails and you're into short tails.
Oh, dear God.
I saw that this year. When he was away, I got to go and clean and feed the or clean them.
Well, that's the thing. It's like I haven't set up with Matt in a while where it's like, I know what he's got. Dude, I know what he's got egg wise. Like I keep seeing the moms on the eggs and I'm like, cool, that thing's awesome. I have not seen his shit for like 2 years. Like I haven't seen the stuff that he has been producing, that he's been raising, that he's been holding back. I haven't seen them for like 2 years.
He's the Borneo king, man. There's nobody better. There's nobody better. He has the best. His snakes are amazing.
I'm
a little
jealous. He got more rough scales this year. I'm only slightly jealous. I feel like I can't be jealous of him, but I am. So I can't explain it either. So
I get it.
Yeah.
All right. That's all I got. Yeah,
that's it. We'll say thanks everyone for listening. We'll catch everybody back here next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.